Inevitably, when you have it on television, you have to find a way to get over the fact that everything's happening inside Volander's head. I mean, when I go to a crime novel also, I want something that seems to me to have a more authentic feel about how life is lived by people who do these kind of jobs. I think if you were actually as depressive as Volander, it would be very hard to imagine anybody actually being able to hold down a job as responsible as a senior police officer. Because it seems to me he spends a large chunk of every book just sitting around being really depressed.
Well, yeah.
I should have a sick note, really.
there are quite beautiful bits within them, though, aren't there? There are beautiful, stylish bits of writing as well. When there's a moment in one of the later books when he thinks, I'm turning into my father now, and there's nothing to look forward to, and I've seen so many dead bodies, and I will be dead for as long as they're dead.
And I'll just go out and shoot myself now. You see, on the other hand, you can have a writer like the Icelandic writer, Arnaldur Indriðason, who writes also about very dark subjects and has a character whose life on the face of it is really awful. You know, he's divorced, his daughter's a junkie, his son he has no relationship with to speak of. Well, and yet there's a life in those books that to me, that isn't there in the Volander books.
Well, just to keep things on the kind of light and happy note that we've been drawing at this point, the name that's really, the detective who's really been hitting the bestseller lists is the creation of Norway's Joe Nesbø, and that's Detective Inspector Harry Hula. And we can now hear a section from his book, The Redeemer.
It was the shortest day of the year, but for Inspector Harry Hula, the day seemed impossibly long before it had even started. After hearing the news of Halvorsen's death, he'd first gone for a walk outdoors, trudged through the deep snow to the woods, and sat there, watching daybreak. He had hoped the cold would freeze, alleviate, or at least numb his feelings. And then he'd walked back. Martine had watched him with questions in her eyes, but said nothing. He'd drunk a cup of coffee, kissed her on the cheek, and got into the car. In the mirror, Martine had seemed even smaller, standing on the step with her arms crossed. Harry drove home, had a shower, changed clothes, and flicked through the papers on the coffee table 3 times before giving up, bewildered.
Now, you see, even though that sounds very dark, what the Joe Nesbø books have, that also the Sjöwall and Valo books had, they're shot through with humour. There's black humour in there. And so that gives you a sense of balance, I think, that is not always obvious.
And there's another factor that, as well as humour, comes into them, I think, Val. It's also a sense of honour. I mean, Harry Hula is a detective who seems to have a very strong moral code that is not necessarily always at odds with what the law actually said. And maybe that's part of being in what seems to be a relatively small and enclosed community.
Yeah, I think there is a theme that runs through a lot of Scandinavian crime fiction about the notion that the law and justice are not always the same thing, and that in a modern social democratic society, there should be a conscious effort to try and bring those two things together. And I think that the Harry Hula does suffer very greatly when he feels that his occupation as a police officer doesn't deliver what feels like justice.
I mean, Louise, it strikes me that, you know, going back a century before Joe Nesbø actually came along, if we think about Ibsen, perhaps, you know, still the best-known Norwegian author of all, a lot of his plays have very much this same sort of tension between the rules of the community, often restrictive rules, and what the protagonist is actually expected to do that may be in conflict with them.
Absolutely, and I guess ideas of feminism as well, which I think is impossible to leave out of discussions about Scandinavian crime fiction. And I think both Stieg Larsson and Joe Nesbø have been discussed in those terms, how their main central female characters operate. And some feminists think that Stieg Larsson's books have too much sadism within them. Some think that Joe Nesbø's crime fiction has a kind of critique of women who don't stay within the home, who don't take on traditional, if you like, female roles. Whether we agree with that or not is a different thing, I think.
Well, I mean, Val, do you agree with that? Is there a male-female divide in terms of the Scandinavian writers?
I don't know that I would characterise it quite in those terms, although it is fair to say that if you're looking at a more domestic kind of crime fiction, then you would turn, by and large, to writers like Camilla Läckberg or the Icelandic writer Ísra Sigurðardóttir, who both write books that have, if you like, a more domestic context to the detection. But on the other hand, you have a writer like Anna Holt, who was the Norwegian Minister for Justice, whose books do have that absolutely searing critique of gender relationships as well as the broader societal relationships. And so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, there are some lines you can draw, but it's hard to say that there's a definite divide.
I think that's part of the interesting thing of the discussion, isn't it? Because I'm not sure in the Stieg Larsson books quite where I come down on, are they exploitative? Are they too sadistic? It's true that sometimes you need to show things in order for people to feel them and to realise them. And I think the original title of the trilogy was Men Who Hate Women. And I think as soon as you attach that title to it, it becomes a very different thing.
And I'm afraid that's all we have time for this evening. So many thanks to my guests Val McDermid, Louise Welsh and John Shrapnel.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Eliane Glazer. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for our Scandinavian prom with the really marvellous Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra. We're about to hear them perform Danish composer Carl Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable, an epic, powerful work through which Nielsen wants to express nothing less than, I quote, what we understand by zest for life, or expressions of life, that which is life. Well, it's a work which is extremely close to the heart of tonight's conductor, Zaki Oramo. Indeed, it's the piece he conducted with the CBSO at his proms debut.
It was almost to the day 12 years ago when I did my first prom with the CBSO. Of course, it was a very different situation. I was terribly nervous then. But this piece is gone with me all the time, and it's probably the symphony that I've conducted most performances of in these last 12 years. And I find it a very important piece in music and in this era. It's kind of interesting to think about Nielsen and Sibelius as exact contemporaries. They were both born in 1865, but how big a difference there was between the two composers' music and also in their personalities. And apparently they didn't get along very well, which is funny, because they had a very good common friend in Wilhelm Stenhammar, who was the Swedish composer and who organized these kind of gatherings of Nordic composers at the time. And it appears that Sibelius and Nielsen couldn't talk about anything. And I think Nielsen went much further in developing music and musical language, but I think his influence has been overlooked quite a lot. I mean, he was really one of the first, together with Charles Ives, to create situations in music that, for instance, have several existing layers of tempo at the same time. I think also the point about Nielsen that's quite often not thought about is he was a great humorist in music as well. This Fourth Symphony maybe doesn't give it out so much because it is a very existential kind of work, which the name Inextinguishable also very much gives out, but he wants to bring out the inextinguishable nature of life and how life always gets over the biggest difficulties.
Because he wrote it pretty much in response to the horrors of the First World War.
Yes, yes, which I don't think actually touched him personally very much, geographically seen, but all the more on a psychological level. And I can't think of a stronger reaction to war in music than this piece is, actually.
When it was first performed, it did get a very, very strong reaction from the audience, who it clearly spoke to very strongly. Do you still find it has that resonance now in modern times?
It varies quite a bit. And sometimes I find there is some strange barrier between Nielsen and the listener of our time. And I don't know if it's got to do with the appearance of the music, which is quite serious and stern in many ways, but there are so many riches in it to be appreciated. And I think a good performance at least tries to bring out these riches, which are melodic, which are harmonic, which are rhythmic. Yeah, just a very good piece.
It's Sakari Oromo's personal mission, I feel, to break down the barriers that can sometimes exist between audiences and Nielsen's work, and I'm sure the passion which comes across so forcefully in his interview there will come across in tonight's performance. Well, here he is coming to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall to perform Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable, with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra.
Thank you.
We expected passion, and that's exactly what we got from Zachary Oromo, the glorious finale there to Nielsen's fourth symphony, The Inextinguishable. The Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra playing out of their boots for Zachary Oromo. Particular mention, I think, should go to the two timpani players, Anders Haag and Daniel Norberg. What a duel in that last section. Absolutely thrilling stuff. After the first performance of the Fourth Symphony, Nielsen, the composer, said, "The title Inextinguishable suggests something that only music itself can express fully, the elementary will of life. Music is life," he said, "whereas the other arts only depict life. Life is unquenchable and inextinguishable. Yesterday, today and tomorrow, life was, is and will be in struggle, in conflict, procreation and destruction, and everything returns. Music is life and as such, inextinguishable." The cheers you can hear as Zachary Oromo brings each section of his orchestra to their feet. And not surprisingly, the loudest did go to those two timpani players I mentioned earlier. He is applauding his musicians and looks extremely pleased, and rightly so. This is his third season with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic. He's just signed up for another 4 years. It is clearly a very happy relationship. He's got big ambitions. He wants them to be bigger players on the international stage, really raise their profile. He says it's an orchestra with a big heart, which loves music. He feels he can express his thoughts to the musicians in a most sincere way. I think you can hear what's happening here. They're desperate for an encore. Zachary Oromo coming back on stage to take the applause again, to bring the orchestra to their feet once more. This orchestra that he says is so healthy, that's so very well loved in its hometown of Stockholm. And it seems we are going to have an encore.
About every other Nordic country, but not from Sweden. So now it is time to pay tribute to the Swedish shepherdess. This is a shepherdess's dance by Hugo Alpin.
Charming encore there. The Valflippen's dance. We've been practicing that all afternoon. The Shepherdess's dance from the Berger Kungen Suite by Hugo Alvén, Swedish composer. I think if the audience here weren't slightly in love with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic before, they certainly are now. Lovely response to that encore, and indeed to this entire prom, conducted by Sakari Ormo, an extremely charming conductor, greatly loved by his musicians and by everybody here. Really entertaining to watch, I must say. Very comical, a real dancer on the podium. And as the applause and the cheers for the Swedes continue here at the Royal Albert Hall, I think it's time for me to tell you about tomorrow night's prom, when the BBC National Orchestra of Wales will be here with François-Xavier Roth conducting Bridge and Couplet and the Saint-Saëns Symphony, also with a London premiere of Simon Holt's Centaur Marchi. That is at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, live, of course, here on BBC Radio 3, so I do hope you'll tune into that. I do hope you've enjoyed tonight's prom at home as much as we have here. Thank you for joining us this evening, but it's time for me to hand you back now to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Katie, thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall presenting tonight's prom. You can hear it again on Friday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock, or indeed any time you like, online over the next 7 days. Just go to the Radio 3 homepage and follow the Listen Again links. Well, as well as that live prom from the BBC National Orchestra of Wales tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, which Katie just mentioned, tomorrow afternoon, another chance to hear last Friday's prom, one of the most highly praised and most enjoyed concerts of the season so far, Mahler's Second Symphony, in the performance by the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra of Venezuela and the National Youth Choir of Great Britain, soloists Mia Persson and Anna Larsson, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. Mahler's Second Symphony, last Friday night's prom, another airing for that tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3 from 2 o'clock.
Four Saturday afternoon concerts from the BBC Proms. On BBC Radio 3, the Proms Saturday matinee concerts bring together the music of Richard Rodney Bennett, Harrison Birtwistle, Hildegard of Bingen and Sofia Gubaidulina in the spectacular acoustic of London's Cadogan Hall. Hear every note here on BBC Radio 3 and join me, Christopher Cook, for the first of the four this Saturday afternoon from 3 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening, and our next programme is the Lebrecht interview tonight. Norman Lebrecht is in conversation with the pianist and composer Sir Richard Rodney Bennett. That follows at 10 o'clock. So before then, here's some piano music by Saint-Saëns. music by Saint-Saëns, inspired by a visit to the Canary Islands. That was one of his Opus 111 studies, Les Cloches de Las Palmas, and it was played there by Piers Lane. And as we heard earlier, Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony is the main work in the second half of tomorrow night's prom from the BBC National Orchestra Wales. The whole concert begins on Radio 3 here at 7 o'clock. Well, at 10:45 tonight, we have the first of this week's essays, just three editions of the programme this week, and Scottish medieval history is the theme. Tonight we're introduced to Scotland's King James I. That's at 10:45, and it's followed at 11 o'clock by Jazz on 3 with Jez Nelson. Now, though, at just after 10 o'clock on BBC Radio 3, it's time for another programme in our summer series in which Norman Lebrecht is talking to leading musicians, the Lebrecht Interview.
Sir Richard Rodney Bennett is... perhaps was, four composers in one. He's most widely known for film and television scores, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Murder on the Orient Express, Far from the Madding Crowd, creating atmospheres to order for a demanding director. He was once the only pupil of Pierre Boulez, a time when he wrote the most rigorous serialism. He's also composed three symphonies, two ballets, numerous concertos. He writes torch songs. Name another composer who covers so much musical waterfront. 75 this year, Bennett was born in Broadstairs, schooled in Reading, and has lived the last third of his life in New York, though without ever losing his engagement with English music, where he has legions of young friends and collaborators. He's a gifted pianist who once gave the British premiere of Boulez's piano sonata. He's also a smoky-voiced club singer. Music does not always appreciate its polymaths. Benjamin Britten attacked his opera The Mines of Sulphur for being slapdash. Classical oligarchs sniff at those who make popular money. I sometimes wonder whether Bennett himself ever found a centre of gravity. Lately, he's talked of having given up composing, as if it were a chapter of life that he can open and shut at will. We meet in London ahead of Jazz Calendar at the Proms. Richard Rodney Bennett, does London still feel like home?
Yes, in a funny way it does. It's rather like my family. I've got a flat here, and I love coming back. It's like a holiday home, but of a very superior kind. And in a way, I'm always performing when I'm here. You know, I work all the time with Claire Martin. And I love it, and if I want to write music, I can. And if I want to sit in the garden all day, I can, too.
I ask the question not out of local patriotism, but to seek a sense of where you best belong, here or there.
I belong at my desk, and I belong in the kitchen because I love to cook. I don't much more want to go to concerts and things. I really don't, either here or in New York. But actually, I'd be more likely to go to what the Americans call an exhibit, an art museum, because that interests me so much more now than what is going on in music. It's an awful thing to say, but there it is.
Your parents were musical. Your father wrote ballad lyrics and children's books.
My father had been a professional singer, and he had to give it up for health reasons, and he started writing drawing room ballad lyrics to earn his living long before I was born. And my mother didn't approve very much. But
she was a pupil of Gustav
Holst.
She was
a pupil of Holst.
She went to St. Paul's?
She went to St. Paul's.
So she was very proper.
Yes, she sang in the first performance of The Planets in the offstage chorus, which is quite good, because she was in the sixth form at St. Paul's at the time. And then she went on to the Royal College of Music, and she studied with Holst. So Holst was rather my grandfather figure when I was a child. But she was there at a very talented time with Rubra and Howard Ferguson, who was one of my teachers, and Lambert. She was slightly before Elizabeth McConkie and Liz Lutyens. But it was an extraordinary time, and there was nothing comparable going on at the Academy in those days.
Between the two of them, they had these rather middle-class musical prejudices. English art song, yes. Noel Coward, no.
Oh, well, they were great friends of Roger Quilter. My father collaborated with Roger Quilter on, I think, a light opera that was actually done at Covent Garden, which seems strange. I never really liked Quilter's music, although he was a lovely man. I was interested in music that was more exotic, i.e. Peter Warlock. I love Warlock.
As a child?
Yes. My parents reviewed music a lot for music magazines in the 1920s. So we had a great wooden chest, like 5 feet long, that was full of mostly vocal music from between the wars, which they had reviewed. Some by composers you've never heard of. I mean, even you have never heard of, but who were well known at one time. And others, composers like Van Deeren.
Oh, gosh.
And lots of Walton, lots of Bridge. And I thought it was too exciting for any words.
And you were reading these scores like comics as a kid?
Sort of, yes. And I could read music very early because my father had a theory that if a child could learn to read words, they could learn to read music too. And so I could go to this chest full of music and drag out these things by composers I'd never heard of. And I was fascinated. I really was. It was so exciting. And then it was so sad because later on in my life, when I was grown up, my mother moved house. And I think she wanted to get rid of that part of her life. And she gave it all away without telling me. I was distraught, but I couldn't do anything. Anyway, so Peter Warlock, I loved when I was a child much
more. What
was
it? A whiff of danger there? Did you, even as a child, did you sense something?
Something exotic.
Yes.
And I knew there was something.
A bit naughty?
More than naughty. There was something wicked about Warlock. And I did love the songs. I loved the harmony particularly, in a way that I never loved Roger Quilters. It didn't do it to me, speak to me in that way. But I did grow up on British music between the wars. And the fact that she had known Howard and Constant Lambert and so on as a student meant that they were sort of very glamorous figures for me.
And Noel Coward, when did you start listening?
Well, I was very good at finding things on the bookshelves which I shouldn't have been reading. And I did find a little book called The Complete Sketches and Lyrics of Noel Coward. And I thought, aha, and started reading them. And of course, quite a lot of those sketches from the 20s are quite sort of
risque.
Yes, risque is the word. And I was fascinated. And I, when I was about six, we were all sitting around the table at lunch, and I said, Daddy, did you know Noel Coward? Well, there was a terrible, terrible freezing silence. And my mother said after lunch, she said, Darling, don't ask Daddy about Noel Coward. So, of course, it made me want even more to find out. I mean, I loved the tunes. I loved the tunes, and I loved the lyrics. And whereas, for example, I love the tunes of Ivan Novello, but you can't read the lyrics. You can't. But Noel Coward goes on fresh as paint, as far as I'm concerned. So Warlock and Coward, both of whom were slightly wicked, were staple backbones of my childhood. And my mother, when she was at the college, and she was a very good pianist, played Debussy and Ravel particularly. And she had some lessons from Marguerite Long. And so I found all that sheet music early on and tried to play it. And my mother would play me Debussy arabesques and so on. And that was so important to me. So my other parentage, so to speak, was French.
You started writing music when you were about five, doodling.
I started writing music when I was about six. I mean, music that you could actually play. But they had exotic titles. I like the titles, and that comes directly, I know, from the Debussy Preludes. And bit by bit, I started actually writing pieces and setting little poems and so on. And from the age of nine, I was at a very good prep school in Kent called Bettshanger School, now called Northbourne Park, and I started writing little things for the choir to sing and, you know, piano duets that I could play and so on. And it was a very good thing for me to be doing. And it's partly because my parents encouraged me to write for what was around me. So I never went through that fatal thing of writing Symphony No. 1 at the top of a page. And then you can't turn the page, of course.
Your father's quite a remote character for you.
Yes.
He's semi-invalid.
Yes.
And you told your biographers you didn't really understand him. Didn't have a sense of him.
I hardly remember him.
Was it like growing up fatherless? Was there an absence that you felt?
Yes. And much later in my life, I mean, 20 years ago, I was with a therapist in New York because I had to give up smoking. I was a heavy smoker. One of the reasons I've actually nearly stopped writing music is I can't write music without smoking. Not that I'm craving. I'm not. But we did talk a lot about my parents. which was very interesting. And the question of my father came up over and over and over again. And I realised I hadn't known him, which was very sad. I think it was rather his fault. I mean, I don't mean that I may have been a horrible little boy, but I think he didn't really want to be with me.
Did he have more of a relationship with your sisters?
Yes, when they were very young. But my mother was rather jealous, and she kept him away from us. And
from you in particular. Yes. You were hers.
Yes. Well, I made such a noise. I mean, I was always forever playing the piano.
Right.
So I was sent to a really dreadful prep school when I was 7 years old, and it was to get me out of the house.
To get you away from him?
Yes, because he was always writing at home, writing children's books later in his life.
You were sent to boarding schools pretty much throughout your schooling.
Well, at 7 years old, I had never been away from home before, and it was terrible. It was a terrible school. The bullying was rampant, and it was not friendly. It was not cosy. It was only 2.5 miles away from home, but it might have been in Siberia.
Did you feel rejected?
One didn't use those words. My therapist told me that I thought I was being punished by being sent away from home for being naughty. And that's possible. But it was awful. But then, thank God, I went to this lovely school where we were allowed to be good at what we were good at. When it was the same thing at my Quaker public school. And there was a terrific music master who was also a composer. And they just let me do it.
By 18, you'd written 3 string quartets and were working on a documentary film.
19
for the film. And you come down to London to the Royal Academy of Music, and you must have felt that you were some way ahead of the game. And you were being sent to study with Lennox Barclay and Howard Ferguson.
I didn't think I was big stuff. It was what I loved to do more than anything in the world. What I learnt at the Academy was precious little, but I did choose to play a great deal of contemporary music, and that was marvellous. And that was one of the best things.
Where did that come from? Where did you find that?
Well, actually, I did a lot of my musical education, more than I ever did at the Royal Academy of Music, at the Westminster Music Library in Buckingham Palace Road, which had a terrific collection.
Like so many of us, yes. Absolutely.
Oh, God, I remember sitting at these little tables drinking in, you know, Bartok and stuff that I'd never seen, and Webern and so on. It was marvellous. So that was where I really educated myself. Lennox Barclay, who was the nicest man in the world, the kindest, he wasn't tough enough for me. I needed someone who was tough, because I was very facile. Lennox, he should have said, as Howard Ferguson did, "Richard, this is awful. Why did you write this?" And I went to Howard Ferguson, bless him, because Lennox went away to write the opera Nelson. And first of all, I went to Priya Rainier, who was a very good composer and a very splendid lady. But I wasn't allowed to stay with her because chaps weren't allowed to study with female teachers, would you believe? So I went to Howard Ferguson, who I hadn't chosen, and he was a perfect teacher for me. He was such a good guy. And he was tough in a funny way. Anyway.
Lizzie Lutyens wasn't planned.
No. I was going back to my prep school, and I changed trains at Victoria Station, and there was an hour to wait, so I went and bought a music magazine, and it was called the Chesterian, rather strangely, and it was the house magazine of Chester's, the music publishers. Why it was being sold on Victoria Station, I can't imagine. But anyway, I opened it, and there was a review of a cantata called Au Saison, Au Château, which was by Elizabeth Lutyens, and it was scored for high soprano, mandolin, guitar, harp and string orchestra, and it was a poem by Rimbaud. Well, that's not your typical English music, or it wasn't in 1947. And I read the magic words 12-tone for the first time, 12-tone technique. And I hadn't heard it, but it rang a bell. I thought, I want to find out about that. And there were a few little pieces of Lizzie's published at that time, and I got hold of them, and I find them totally mysterious, and tried to play them, and whenever I played them, my mother would come into the room and said, "Darling, what on earth are you playing?" Because it did sound pretty weird, particularly played by me at the age of 12 or whatever. And I called Liz Lutyens on the telephone one day, and she thought it was a lady because my voice hadn't broken. And I said, can I show you my music? And she said, yes, come and see me. Well, Liz was a very, very difficult woman in many, many ways. But she had a gift for youth. And she had a gift for encouraging the talent of young people. So I used to go up and see her at half term, and it was marvellous. And she introduced me, I guess, to... No, not to Serial Technique. I did find out about that. But the world of being a composer. And she was writing atonal music, which was deeply unfashionable. And she was doing movies to earn her living. And Liz was struggling away doing documentaries. She only did a couple of features later on in her life because they wouldn't give a big feature film to a woman to write the music of.
Especially one as difficult as she was.
Well, yes, and tending to be rather drunk, using those words, which we can't even say on this
program. Was this the first time that you heard those words?
No, she didn't use them to me, but she was notorious for her language. And later on, when I was at the Academy, Malcolm Williamson, who was a great buddy of mine, and I used to go down to spend days in Blackheath, where she lived at that time, with her. And that was so exciting. It was so exciting looking at these new works. Then the four-letter words came out thick and fast then, but not when I was a schoolboy. And she just made writing music seem so exciting. But Liz was something else. She was marvellous.
You fell out with her. She fell out with everyone.
She fell out with everyone. But I was very impressionable and very facile, and I copied one or two of her ideas and the instrumentation and some of the poems she set and so on. I was 17, for goodness sake. Then later on, when I was in my early 20s, I think, I heard she'd been bad-mouthing me to some students of mine in a class at Dartington, and I wrote to her and I said, you cannot do this. You can badmouth me to anybody in the profession, but not to my students. And I think it shook her rather, and we were friends after that.
Your other friend at the Academy was Cornelius Cardew.
Yes. We met at the Academy because we were both involved in running a new music club where we played Schoenberg and all kinds of daring things like that. Not supported by the Academy in any way. It was sort of illegal, really, what we were doing. And I got to know Cornelius, or Cor, as he was called, as we called him. And he was a very good pianist. And one thinks of him now as a sort of crazy political person. He was a very good pianist. And he was a very good collaborating pianist, which is the word I prefer to use rather than accompanist. And we did a lot of two-piano music together. And we compared notes, and we were both doing mad things with number series and so on, which is a thing we had to go through. As my mother would have said, it was just a phase he's going through. Well, it was just a phase that I went through for about 3 years. And so was Cornelius. And he had a great sense of humour, and he was sort of crazy. And we were great buddies. We used to go to Darmstadt. Mm-hmm. Now, Darmstadt in the 50s, as I know you know, was an important centre for new music of a kind that didn't exist in this country. And Boulez was there, and Stockhausen was there, and Berio was there, and Henri Pousseau was there, who was a marvellous Belgian composer, and Henze was there.
Did you catch John Cage? Was he still there?
Yes, that was, I think, the last year I went. Boy, did he shake them up. Because he was so funny and so approachable. I remember going to talks he did, just rolling around laughing because John Cage was so funny. And he really made people think. Because, of course, it was diametrically opposed to anything that any of the other composers were doing. And we used to get some funny magazine, and I can't remember what it was called, but it used to list what was going on the German radio stations. So Cornelius and I and his lovely wife, Ruth, used to sit up very late listening to Radio Stuttgart through a haze of crackling and banging, you know, and hearing new music. And it was the only thing we could do. Like when we were at Darmstadt, we used to spend hours in the library copying manuscripts out by hand because there wasn't photocopying, of course. This was 1955. Well, maybe there was, but we didn't have access to photocopying machines. And I still have manuscript copies I have of Stockhausen piano pieces that weren't published then.
You gave the premiere of Boulez's Structure with Cornelius.
That was
beforehand.
Yes.
You did the sonata yourself, the British premiere, the Boulez sonata. You had your own sonata published by Universal. You're not even 20 years old yet. And at the same time, you're playing jazz and doing the clubs and finding that otherness.
When I was at school, I was writing music. And you can imagine this was pretty strange for the other boys. They didn't know what it was about. And so there was a frightful danger that my latest opus would be just taken away, hidden. But I found that if I could play popular tunes, which I loved doing, I was left in peace, you know. They said, if they said play ta-da-da-da-da-da, which they'd heard on the radio, I could play it. Also, incidentally, I used to go in for talent shows a lot to make money, because I wasn't given pocket money. I don't know why, but I wasn't. And I used to go over on the bus to Exmouth every few weeks and go in for a talent show and win 5 shillings. Generally, I won. If I didn't, I was jolly cross. But I used to win 5 shillings and go racing off to a rather extraordinary music shop that there was in the back streets of Exmouth and buy Bartok. I remember doing that. And manuscript paper. And the occasional record. And so I was very practically oriented, and particularly financially. I wanted to make a bit of money so I could find out about the music that I wanted to find out about.
And then you wrote to Pierre Boulez and said, will you take me on as your pupil?
He heard. He was in London as a musical director for Jean-Louis Barou, and he heard there was this English, young English man who, maybe I had met him already, I don't know, who was playing his first piano sonata, and he said, could you hear it? And he did. I played it to him, and he was marvellous. He was marvellous. And we got on so well, and he was very encouraging, and I wrote to him, dear Mr. Boulez, can I come and study with you? And he said, yes. In this teeny, teeny handwriting, teeny, like written with the point of a pin. And I went to Paris.
Your mother was not pleased.
Well, I think she thought he was going to drag me down into nameless, I don't mean sexual, nameless things, you know, drinking absinthe and so on. But, of course, Boulez was, he was quite distant, not distant in an unfriendly way, but we were never chums. He was a great teacher. He was marvellous for me. But more importantly, I was away from home. I was away from school. I was away from the academy. I was in Paris when I was 20, and I knew a lot of painters and writers and young composers, and it was the best time of my life. No, not the best time of my life. It was a marvellous time.
You were free?
I was free. And sexually, I was able, so to speak, to come out.
Was it easier to be gay in Paris at the time than it was in London?
I didn't do anything about it. But I knew I could. I wasn't going to scandalise anybody. And I knew some fairly distinguished people who were gay. And so I was in a world which, you know, it was okay.
And Boulez, tell me a little bit more about him at the time. We see him now as an éminence grise. He was rather more austere.
He was quite austere. And he tended to come out with ridiculous pronouncements about music that he disapproved of. He couldn't stand Ravel, for example. And I always had a passion for Schubert, particularly for the forehand music. And he didn't approve of that at all. So I tended to keep my lip buttoned when it was anything that would provoke him, because he was very intolerant. But he was a great teacher for me.
Were you a little frightened of him?
Yes. I still am.
Did you stay in touch afterwards?
I worked for him a lot as a pianist. I mean, one of the reasons I don't play classical, quote, classical music anymore is there are lots of marvellous pianists around. But when I came back from Paris in 1959 and then on, there were only a couple of pianists in this country, myself and Susan Bradshaw, who was my buddy for years and years and years, and Margaret Kitchen, who was Howard Hartog's wife, who could deal with those kind of difficulties. So I don't know if even you know this, but there was a performance of Gruppen, of Stockhausen, in Glasgow in about 1959, not later, conducted by John Carew, Alexander Gibson and Norman Delmar, the three conductors. And I went up to Glasgow to play the large piano part. Anyway, I worked a lot for Boulez because I could deal with those kind of difficulties. I loved working for him, and he was so understanding of the difficulties of the kind of music that I was playing.
And all the while you're writing film music? You're making your living?
You are hopping to and fro.
Well, these are your parallel lives. You're doing all of this at the same time. That's what's astonishing to me.
I wanted to earn my living. Most of the people I knew, including
through
the
1960s, you wrote 20 film scores along with everything else.
No, so I did. Most of the composers I knew taught tiny children to play the piano, which I never did do. I wouldn't have known how to anyway. And they pulled those things in coffee bars, you know. All, most of my friends worked in
espresso machines.
El Cubano and those. Well, I could do something that was more me, I mean, in the sense of being a jazz pianist, and writing film music. And Howard Ferguson introduced me to a lovely man who was a musical director called John Hollingsworth. And I had done a fake film score just to amuse myself, and so I was able to show it to him. And he gave me my first film, which was about insurance. And there were always peals of laughter when I say that, but actually insurance was quite exciting because it started around the time of the fires, the Great Fire of London, and the Industrial Revolution, and all kinds of catastrophic things that happened. And there was I writing music for those things as they came up in documentary pieces, you know. And it was for chamber orchestra. And of course, in those days, you could get an orchestra. Mm. And my first oboe player was Leon Goossens. And whereas at the Academy, I had never had anything played at all, except by my friends sometimes. Mm. And all of a sudden, there I was in a grown-up recording studio being played, as it were, by Leon Goossens. And I knew it wasn't good music, and I knew it had been written at the speed of light. But it was so exciting writing something which people needed, which was going to be played next week. And then I was 26, I think, I suddenly realised that I'd only written about 8 minutes of my own music that year, but I had done 4 films. And I thought, wait a minute, that's not quite right. Because I never had any particular respect for film music as a kind of music. I mean, I respected a lot of the composers who wrote for it, but I didn't think I was writing important music. But I got work doing it. And my first film, The Insurance, I got paid £100, which was out of sight. And it was easy for me to do.
Your first full-length opera, The Mines of Sulphur, was staged at Sadler's Wells, 18th-century costume drama commissioned and conducted by Colin Davis, and pretty highly praised all round.
Yes.
Except by Benjamin Britten, who wrote to you in both sorrow and anger.
He wasn't angry.
Well, this is what he wrote. To start with, I wasn't struck by many of the ideas. My first impression was rather as if it were dashed off. You were relying on vitality and volume for your effects. I found a serious lack of characterization. Very preachy, very spiteful letter.
Ben didn't like other composers very much. And he went on performing my music at Aldeburgh. And Peter also went on singing my music, who was a much, I have to say, nicer person than Ben. But no, Ben was not trying to do me down, but he didn't like other composers very much. And he may have been right. I may have written it too fast, but it was a damn good opera.
Richard, you get that letter from the best composer in the country. What do you feel reading it?
I remember feeling slightly sick. It hurt. You know, it wasn't that I wanted fulsome praise, but I did hope he'd like it, and he clearly didn't like it.
The Mines of Sulphur went to La Scala.
It went to La Scala, where it was a catastrophe.
Ah. Who took it to La Scala?
You know, it was a big success.
Mm.
The reviews were fantastic.
And it was on television.
It was televised complete, which was fairly thrilling.
And unusual.
Also, yes. Oh, very unusual. And I think after La Scala, it was done in Marseille, at the opera there, in a brilliant production. And it was done in Cologne, it was done in Stockholm, and it was done in New York at the Juilliard School, and it was done in Los Angeles, and it was very successful. And then later on, I mean in the 70s probably, one of the Sunday newspaper critics said, why are they reviving The Mines of Sulphur? It was mildly successful at the time. And I wanted to write to him and say, how can you say this? It was a new opera by a young composer. It had 7 different productions and was translated into 4 languages. I mean, but that's the English way. You get a little slap.
Would it work today? Is it worth reviving?
Yes. It was revived 2 years ago at Glimmerglass in New York State in a marvellous production with terrific singers and a great conductor called Stuart Robertson, who is a Scottish conductor who works out there. I was so proud of it. It was like a grandchild, you know? And then it was done at City Centre in New York, and I loved it. I loved it. But The Mind Itself was a long time ago. And then I went on and I wrote a couple of other operas, and they weren't so good. They were all right, but I mean, they were very professional, but they didn't work like The Mind Itself.
It was around that time that you met and fell in love with the young tenor, Dan Klein,
yes,
who became your life's partner.
Yes.
And also around the time of meeting him that you wrote your first symphony.
Yes. I was
Cause
writing...
Cause and effect?
No? Well, partly. I was in the middle of writing it when I met him. And I had written the first movement, and I went home to write the second movement, and it was about him, which I don't often do. I've never done it, actually, before or since. And we were together for 15, 16 years, and it was marvellous. And it was marvellous. He was with me through all those successful years of mine in the late 60s, early 70s. And we were very close, and he died 2 years ago, by which time we had broken up. But we remained friends and saw one another fairly often.
You wrote for his voice?
Yes, I wrote a couple of pieces. And we did a lot of recitals together. Because I have always, and this is another thing we haven't touched on, I've always been a very keen collaborating pianist. And a collaborating pianist, which I was, and my mother was, incidentally, and a lot of true musicians that I know, they were good at working with other people. But a certain race of pianists, and they often have perfect pitch, and they can often sight read very well, they're born to work with other people, and I'm like that.
And the film work was becoming richer, more ornate. Nicholas and Alexandra, Murder on the Orient Express. Did you always do your own orchestrations?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That was the chief pleasure for me, because I could have such extravagant orchestras, large orchestras, and I could have some very eccentric orchestras that there'd be no point writing for in the concert hall because nobody would ever play them. And I did enjoy the orchestration, yes. Sometimes writing the music was absolute murder. It was agony to get that much music written so fast. But I did love the orchestration. And it wasn't until I did the music for Gormenghast, enormous. And that had 93 minutes music in. Hello? And I really compose it all. I mean, I don't write a tune and then have somebody take it away. And I knew I couldn't write this enormous pages of full score, because it's a big orchestra. So I gave it to my friend John Wilson, who's a marvellous conductor and orchestrator. At least I sent it to him. I sent very detailed faxes from New York to him in London with all the orchestration cued in, I mean, saying what was what. And he transferred them into full score pages. But that was the only time in my life when I have not done my own orchestration, unless it was something like, you know, an 1830s ballroom sequence, and I don't know how they did it, or a 1920s dance band, because I don't know dance band orchestration. But that's a different kind of music entirely. But yes, I love orchestrating.
Talking to film composers today, they complain of being slaves to the click track, that having to fit in with what's already done for the screen. Did you have more freedom with your directors?
Yes. I may have worked with conductors who liked to use click tracks, but I never wrote to click track. I wrote in a way which is perhaps out of fashion now, which is to do with the speed that the music is going at. That's to say, if you're working at crotchet equals 60, that's about 1, 2, 3, 4. So you can, if you have a 4-4 bar, you know it lasts 4 seconds. And you can plot out the things you need to hit in the music, because it's not certainly not every cut, every detail on the screen. And you can work out a sort of structure like that. But it's not something that's going like that, and you have to play it at that speed, which is so terrible, and that's what click tracks are. And so I did it. I actually enjoyed the little bits of arithmetic that were involved in working from metronome speeds. And in Murder on the Orient Express, where the train leaves Istanbul Station, which is, I guess, a kind of famous piece of film music, when it starts going, it goes... until it gets up to its tempo, which was the tempo of my waltz. And I worked that all out arithmetically, so I could go zonk, and so everything was timed and everything came up right. Sidney Lumet was a marvellous director to work for, but I was taking a big risk writing a waltz for this huge train, you know? And they had spent months getting the right train noises to go with it, and when Sidney heard the waltz, bless him, he said, "We're going to use the music. We're not going to use any noises at all." And people rushed out of the room in tears, and then it was... But they used the waltz.
And it's a wonderful waltz.
It's a good waltz. It's a good waltz. And bless Stephen Sondheim, because I had just seen A Little Night Music, which, of course, is all waltzes. Mm. And he himself says that idea came from La Valse of Ravel. And the La Valse came from Johann Strauss, and Johann Strauss, well... So Steve is sort of responsible for...
For you getting Murder on the Orient Express?
Yeah, well, he's responsible for me getting it. But I learnt a lot from his harmony and his use of the waltz in Little Night Music.
Were you surprised when Frederick Ashton took Jazz Calendar for a ballet with Nureyev?
He wanted to do my first symphony. And I don't know why, but I said, "Don't do that. Do Jazz Calendar," which I still am very fond of. And it didn't occur to me that he would, A, because it was jazz, and B, because it was not for orchestra, it was for jazz, you know, ensemble. And he did. All I did was I wrote about 15 seconds music before the curtain went up as a sort of frontispiece thing. And the curtain went up, and there was this, I think, terrific ballet with marvellous designs by Derek Jarman, with Nureyev and Mill Park and all the great Covent Garden dancers of that time. But I had nothing to do with the ballet. I was just, I sat back and was thrilled.
You went to America in 1979, in part for personal reasons and in part because you felt that you were being resented and sidelined by parts of the music establishment.
I went partly for personal reasons.
You talked of being punished for success in this country.
Well, yes, partly. But I had broken up with Dan, which was very, very painful, and I couldn't stay here if he was with somebody else. I mean, that sounds hysterical, but there it is. But I was accompanying... or collaborating with Jane Manning, Barry Tuckwell, Susan Bradshaw, and Marion Montgomery. And I had so much work as a pianist. And also I was on the Arts Council, so I was on the All Purposes Something or Other Committee and the Opera Committee and the Jazz Committee. And I was endlessly reading scores for performance for the Society for the Promotion of New Music, and so on. And it was all getting too much, and it was sort of weighing me down, and also the breakup was painful. And I suddenly said to Dan one day, because we were still together, I said, "I'm going to live in America. I'm not staying here anymore." And it was a very weird and painful year. That was 1979. But in, I think, October 79, I went. And I got my green card, which is the permit to live there and work there and earn money, without a problem. When they asked for my referees, which you have to have, you know, to say he's OK, I said Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein. And they'd never even checked up with them, because my CV was quite good. I'd done movies that they had heard of, you know, and I was obviously a reputable kind of person. So there we are.
I'm just wondering if in moving to America you found a different kind of jazz, that you felt you were sort of moving closer to the heart of that particular music and of popular music, and that what you'd experienced here was perhaps a little one removed.
Well, no. I mean, the jazz that I knew was basically from records. I mean, it was marvellous to go to the Golden Circle in Stockholm and to hear Bill Evans or to hear Miles Davis in a concert or something. But the music that I really had sat down and listened to, the jazz, was records. But New York, as you know, is or was, actually very much was, the home of late-night